good afternoon. So, there's a few more questions. Here's a quick one. Can you please explain again the difference between subtle and gross distractions? So, a distraction is anything that competes with a meditation object for your attention. And a subtle distraction is one that doesn't compete quite as strongly. So the effect is that your attention, that this represent my meditation object, this represent the distraction, and my attention does alternate between the two. It spends most of the time on the meditation object. Subjectively, it means that I experience my attention as focused on the meditation object. The distraction I'm aware of in the background, it stands out from the background because I'm not knowing it just through peripheral awareness. I'm knowing it as well through those moments of attention where it alternates. As a distraction competes more successfully, it wins more moments of attention. So the effect is that it gradually draws in closer. If it happened in slow motion, you might, and sometimes it does happen this way, you might come to the point of feeling like you are paying attention to the distraction and the meditation object at the same time, equally. So subjectively, it seems like they're right side by side in the focus of your attention. In actual fact, attention is alternating back and forth, but you're not spending equal time with both. As it continues to compete more successfully, meditation object receives fewer moments of attention as compared to the distraction. At that point, your subjective experience is that you're still paying attention to the breath, but it's kind of slipped into the background. And distraction has become more prominent, and that's the point at which it's become a gross distraction. Well, I mean, maybe it's a gross distraction when they're both equal. Equal or more makes it gross, and less makes it subtle. Okay? Is that clear? Yes. This is a question in reference to the body scan. Just at the end of the guided body scan, you ask us to put the attention back to the sensations of the breath at the nose to see if the qualities had changed. The thought arose, it's energy flowing, particles of energy. I don't know if this is the right language. A further thought arose, there is no breath, just energy flowing. And the question is this in the right direction? So, in terms of the meditation, I have to say this is totally a side issue. There is a shift taking place in your perception. And that shift in perception is in the right direction of the meditation process overall, where you have the experience of the way you've always seen things and the way you've taken them for granted. Beginning to give way to other ways of seeing things based on the direct experience you've actually had in the meditation. So in that sense, it's the right direction. In this case, the thought arose, it's energy flowing, particles of energy. And it goes dot, 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 particles of energy in the question. The thought, it's energy flowing, most likely came directly from the experience of observing sensations that change, the wind element sensations. And if you had succeeded in identifying some sensations that changed with the breath, and for example your hands or your legs or your feet or something, then that would have been the trigger for that particular thought. Because yes, in fact, the more prominent these sensations become, the more clearly you perceive them, as you begin to perceive them in more and more of your body at once, then the form of that perception becomes one very clearly of energy flowing, of massive amounts of energy flowing in multiple different directions. and you can follow the currents of those energy, that energy. So it's energy flowing, that thought probably came from the beginning of that different perception. Particles of energy is your mind trying to go back to its usual way of seeing things. I mean, after all, air moving in and out is particles of matter. It's right, atoms and molecules. The second thought, there is no breath, just energy flowing. The problem with these thoughts is they can also be feeding off of things you've heard and read. And your mind is, okay, you've heard and read these things and you feel like, oh, this is a higher perception, it involves insight, things like that. So your mind will, of course, try to make you have those kinds of perceptions. So it's hard to know. Am I seeing it this way because I'm seeing it more clearly? Or am I seeing it this way because I've developed the expectation that sooner or later I'm going to get to a place where I can see it that way? To a certain extent, it doesn't really matter. To the extent that this is a way of seeing things that actually fits your experience better, ultimately that's going to come about. You continue meditating as you continue observing. Your mind has no choice but to shift the way it perceives to better match the experiences that you're having. And so it doesn't matter if you read about them somewhere else first or if your mind is already making that shift. But it's just, I just mentioned that because ideally you want it to come not through expectations and not through the mind trying to fit experience to expectations. And our minds do such a good job of this in every aspect of our life. The mind modifies experience to fit our expectations. And more than anything else in meditation, we're trying to go the other direction, where the mind modifies its expectations to fit the experience. Right? So just keep that in mind. Now, in terms of the meditation and the purpose of this meditation practice, the most right direction for your mind to go in is that as a result of the scanning, it's become more powerful. And so when you come back to the nose, the perception is clearer and sharper and more stable. And that's the most right of right directions. Because we're doing this for the sake of training our mind and for the sake of moving to a place of a superior quality of conscious experience. So, and this particular exercise is to increase the power of the mind, to brighten up the perception. Once the mind has succeeded in shifting into overdrive, so to speak, higher gear anyway, to come back to the breath of the nose, you want to sustain that for as long as possible. And when it begins to fade, you go back and do it again. You ramp it back up and try to hold it there. So that's the most important outcome of this practice. These other things, though, they do have their place and hopefully are communicated that together with a little caveat. After a body scan practice, I can no longer meditate. I just feel empty. I feel very good, but it's just like the car has no more fuel in the tank. Is that normal? Yes, don't worry about that. It takes a lot of energy to... It takes a lot of mental energy to go to these unfamiliar places and search for very subtle sensations. And you can drain your gas tank or your battery or however you want to think of it. You might need a little time to recharge, and that's fine. So you've done the body scan. There's no need to go back and do it again right away. You can just do something that's more pleasant and comfortable and let yourself recharge. So the important thing is that you know what the purpose of the body scan is. And you're training your mind, you're trying to cultivate this increased power of perception. And so you use it as a tool. and you recognize when you've overused the tool and it's time to back off for a while. So, okay, any further questions? Okay.
I have a question on the blood scan. Mostly seems to be easier to find earth type of sensations, tensions, pressures, okay, that kind of things. Should we use those if we don't find anything else? Should we always look for wind type of sensations? Or either one is fine?
Okay, the purpose of using the four elements is you have this myriad of different sensations. And so the purpose of using the four elements is to categorize them so that you can not be bothered with the ones that aren't as relevant. What you're really interested in are wind element, change, sensation. And so it's only, the four elements are only a tool to help. And so use them in that way. What you're really heading towards is being able to examine changing sensations and to discern which, if any, of those are changing in the same rhythm as the breath. So what you do with the earth element sensations or the water or fire element, it's entirely up to you, but what you do with them should be something that is bringing you closer to your goal of detecting sensations to change with the breath, because that's what you're really interested in. Okay? Yes, I know there are in many different traditions meditation practices that you do that are based entirely on the four elements. And those are absolutely fine, but we're doing something a little different here. We're using the four elements for a specific purpose. We're not doing it for their own sake. Yes?
I know it's not the most important one, but I didn't quite get what the water element was.
The water element is... It's, if you think about it, the property of water is it holds together. It's you know how a drop of water forms and it hangs and it holds together. And water has cohesiveness. Sand doesn't have cohesiveness. The water has cohesiveness. It's something that holds the parts together. The other property that water has is fluidity. It can flow and change its shape without losing its cohesiveness. Now, the fact that water can be broken up into particles is a fact about the substance called water. It's not a fact about the water element. The water element is cohesiveness and fluidity. And so it's that property of being able to move and shift and conform to different spatial relationships. So that's... Now, in practical terms and in subjective perceptual terms, when I close my eyes, I feel my hand. And it is this awareness of my hand as an object with a kind of cohesion to it, and I can move the hand, I can press it against other things. And I feel that it never loses its handedness. It's always hand. And I can explore its shape and move through it. So it has the combination of cohesiveness and fluidity. And what I'm looking for are the sensations by which I know that fact. I put my hand there and I say, how do I know my hand has cohesion, that's not like a pile of sand? And I feel that. But how do I know that it has the property of fluidity? Well, see, I can, if I press two fingers together, I immediately experience that fluidity. Right? And here's a question that's been hanging out for a little while. If you're practicing with metacognitive introspective awareness, does everybody know what that is?
No.
Okay, so I'll read the question, I'll read the whole question and we'll go through it. If you're practicing with metacognitive introspective awareness, do you still have an anchor for the attention? If so, what object do you recommend? Or is this a place where Matthew mentioned when he was here where attention and awareness fuse? If it is not here, at some point in the week, would you speak about the fusion of attention and awareness? This is the point. Okay, metacognitive introspective awareness is awareness of your own mind. What's introspective awareness includes being aware of mental objects like thoughts and emotions, but more importantly, it's being aware of the state of your mind and what your mind is doing. For example, being aware of movements of attention, being aware that my attention is on this, but I have this subtle distraction and that subtle distraction. That's being aware of what's happening in my mind. And so the state of my mind, the activity of my state of my mind, am I feeling agitated? Am I relaxed? Am I focused? No. Most of those things that we would describe as emotions are, we could describe as states of mind. And so to the degree that there's restlessness or impatience or joy or satisfaction, all of these things, how strong or how subtle is not important, but they are what we mean by states of mind. So introspective awareness is the awareness of the state of your mind and the activities of your mind, of what's going on in your mind, as opposed to what's going on out here. Metacognitive introspective awareness is where the vantage point from which you're viewing your mind seems to have risen to a higher level. So it's like when I'm at floor level, I can only see the people around me. When I've risen to a higher level, I have a panoramic view of everyone in the room, which I do, thanks to Paul. He made this metacognitive perspective.
He's not.
Where is Paul? I guess him. Anyway, so your mind shifts to this broader perspective, your viewpoint, the vantage point shifts to this broader perspective. And subjectively, what you feel is happening is the mind is watching the mind. If as a part of what the mind is doing, it's paying attention to the sensations of the breath, then the watcher, the witness to the process, is observing the mind, and as a part of the mind is observing the sensations of the breath rising and falling in their focus of attention. So it's part of a large picture. That's metacognitive introspective awareness. So if you're practicing with metacognitive introspective awareness, do you still have an anchor for the attention? If so, what object do you recommend? Okay, I just gave an example. The object for your attention can still be the breath sensations. Or it could be, there's all kinds of other things that it could be. Attention is part of the mind. So from the metacognitive perspective, attention as that part of the mind is doing whatever it's doing. Attention may even be alternating between two or three different things. Attention may be bouncing around from this to this to this, and then back to that. If you are observing this from a metacognitive perspective, that's what you see, is that activity of attention as a part of the total experience. So, yes, attention and an anchor of attention is potentially part of any metacognitive perspective. So if you shift into metacognitive awareness while you're doing meditation, there are some meditations that do not involve an anchor for attention, and there are even some meditations that don't involve attention at all. But if attention is present, and for most meditations that you'd be doing, it does have an anchor, and so the answer, simple answer would be yes. But then, if you want, or is this the place where Matthew mentioned where attention and awareness fuse? It certainly can be. And this is something that when I was talking about the body scanning, I said we can keep adding more and more body parts together to the point where we're following the breath in the entire body at the same time. So it is possible to expand the scope of attention. And the way that they fuse is when the scope of attention and awareness basically become the same. And that can be done, and is, as a matter of fact, ideally done, where you would describe the awareness aspect of, as being metacognitive, and then the attention expands to fuse with it. And that is precisely the perspective from which you should be practicing Mahamudra, should you ever undertake the practice of Mahamudra. You're not really doing Mahamudra until you can enter into a metacognitive perspective where attention has expanded to become fused with awareness. And that metacognitive perspective is the mind watching the mind. And the Mahamudra is really the mind, the meditation on the mind directly. And you utilize the full conscious power. So it's not like we turn attention off, which is something that we can do. And in the jhana practice, you do that. In second, third, fourth jhanas, you turn attention off. Don't need you anymore. Done your job. Thank you. We'll call you when you need you. But in Mahamudra practice, you know, unless really fourth jhana and Mahamudra are pretty much the same. But if you're going directly to Mahamudra without progressing through the jhanas first, then that's exactly what you do. You fuse attention and awareness. So you're bringing the full conscious power of your mind to bear on the investigation of the mind in itself. So that's the fusion aspect of it. So I think I answered all aspects of the question. Is it where attention and awareness fuse? Yes, it can be. I said can be, not is or isn't. If it is not here at some point, because you speak about where it does, yeah. Mahamudra is a really good example. All right. Any further question on this particular topic? Do you have any words of wisdom? I don't know. Regarding wisdom is in the eye of the beholder. Regarding overcoming apathy, are there any specific ways to give it a jolt? Thinking about death, etc. Yeah, apathy, laziness, lethargy, you know, I don't want to do it. First of all, where this has its greatest power is before you've actually commenced an activity. It's as you prepare to begin something that it comes in and it attempts to either divert the energy into some procrastinatory activity or block the action entirely. Okay? And this is the most effective way of dealing with it at this point is you just go ahead and do it. It comes up, just as you're about to start, you just go ahead and do it. As soon as you commence the action, the resistance begins to fade. And that's the most effective thing that you can do. Of course, something gave rise to that resistance, and as you continue the activity, the first obstacle or interruption that you encounter, it's going to move in and try to reassert itself. Right? So, what you have to do is to look a little deeper and ask yourself, where is this resistance coming from? Let's discuss it as laziness, right? Laziness is bad, right? If laziness is bad, why is everybody lazy? Maybe laziness isn't all bad. Maybe it serves a purpose. Maybe we would never have invented washing machines if we weren't lazy. Maybe we would waste our time and energy doing all kinds of things we didn't need to do if we weren't lazy. Maybe somebody else could persuade us to waste all of our time and energy doing things that benefit them and not us if we weren't lazy. Laziness serves a purpose. One of those inborn protective mechanisms that function in the course of our life to try to keep us on track and in balance and not waste our time and energy. So let's respect laziness and the right that it has to be there. Why on earth does laziness arise in a particular situation? How often, as you are preparing to have sex, does laziness interfere? On the other hand, there are occasions where it pretty consistently interferes. If we look at this, what's the difference? Well, it has something to do with the ratio of the expected reward to the amount of energy that puts into it, that we put into it. And in other words, there's a big motivation component. The more motivation you have, the less laziness. Well, I didn't need to go through this logical explanation to lead you to that point. You already know that. Motivation. Motivation is what shifts this around. And so there is a kind of cost-benefit analysis that your mind is carrying out. So you've got to give it the information, you know. The bookkeepers are doing a cost-benefit analysis. If you don't give them all the information, they're going to say, we're going to shut down your project. So, you've got to make sure they have the information. And the way you do that is keeping your motivation clear, your purpose is clear, your goals clear, keeping the evidence that you have available to you that indeed that this is worth doing, the potential rewards, benefits, so on and so forth, the evidence that it does work, because I've seen it work for other people and even worked for me once last week and so forth. All of that kind of thing. Keep yourself motivated. Now, the person who asked this says, thinking about death. Well, that's one thing. That can work. You know, if that assumes that you're already motivated in the sense that you believe that the end of meditation is going to be something very valuable and important that you do want. And then the apathy is coming from, yeah, but why don't we do this next week instead? Right? Then you can counter that with, well, we might not be here next week. So if you already have a certain degree of motivation, you can ramp it up with the urgency factor. And that's really what reflecting on death does. And so it works. But I'm giving you a broader spectrum of possibilities. You use anything that you can to make it more urgent, but first of all, before you make it more urgent, you've got to let the accounting department know that the rewards are worth it, that the risk-reward ratio meets their criteria. Right? Then once they agree to that, you can bring the urgency factor into it. Hope that's helpful. This is called, it's the third of the five hindrances, the hindrance of laziness and lethargy. I've given you the antidote. Just go ahead and do it. Okay. 20 seconds left. Okay, can you give us some tips on how we can better incorporate mindfulness and single-pointed concentration when we're not in meditative state, such as when we're at work, etc.? The biggest problem with mindfulness in daily life is remembering to be mindful. Right? And learning to be mindful in daily life follows exactly the same pattern as learning to keep your attention on the breath. Beginner meditator, I sit down, the intention to meditate on my breath, and I start out really well for the first three breaths. Then I return from 5 minutes of mind wandering. Likewise, I get up in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to be mindful today. I'm mindful of getting dressed, and I'm mindful of this, and then, oh, it's 6 in the evening, and I haven't been mindful. It's exactly the same. And you treat it the same way. At 6 in the evening, you say, ah, wow, at last, I remember to be mindful. Okay, I'm going to be mindful now, from now on, as long as I can. The other thing that you can do is to reflect. If you meditate daily, before you meditate every day, is a great time to reflect on how mindful you've been. You recall the times during the day that you were mindful first, and you say, wow, that was great. Oh yeah, I got that one too. You know, positive feedback. Reward yourself for having been mindful. And then you think about those times that you could have been mindful, but you weren't. And you have a little fantasy about, well, if I'd been mindful, I probably, yeah, I could have done this. And, ooh, that would have changed everything. Yeah, oh, God, right? You're creating an incentive so that tomorrow there's going to be somewhat greater probability that you're going to remember to be mindful. Yeah. So you'll recall specific instances. There's a practice I know that some of you do called keeping a book. And that would be a great way to do this. I mean, essentially, review several times a day of how mindful I've been, have I been since the last time I reviewed this. And do everything you can to positively reinforce those parts of your mind functioning at an unconscious level that are going to be responsible for you remembering to be mindful. The more positive reinforcement that you provide, the more likely it is that those reward-seeking parts of your unconscious mind are going to make it happen. Okay? And so that's enough for today. Thank you.